the Joint Ways and Means to order and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5527, Division of State Lands. Sue, could you give us an update of what we're doing today?
Sure. Mr. Chair, we started with the agency's presentation yesterday, and I think it got about a quarter of the way through their PowerPoint presentation behind tab number one in your smaller binder with the black and white cover. And, of course, they want to continue on with that today. They have provided most of the information that was requested yesterday from members of the subcommittee, and if you'd like, they could go through that briefly before they go into their presentation.
That'd be great. Ann, go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Meserle. For the record, my name is Ann Hannes, Director, Division of State Lands. The packet that we provided to you this morning or this afternoon is what you had requested yesterday. It includes the map that highlights where ownership of state lands are. The report from John Buter is included in here as well. The Oregon Natural Heritage Plan is part of the packet. There is also an audit task work plan timeline that includes all the different tasks that were accomplished by the agency and the status of that. That's with regard to trust properties.
And I see this report from the Heritage Plan is 1998. They have not put together anything since then.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Jeanette Holman, Assistant Director. They are required to update the Heritage Plan every 5 years. They have this year's update pretty much done, but we ran out of money, so we're not going to publish it until after the biennial.
Senator, we've also asked Hal Stompwasser, who is the Dean of the College of Forestry, and Raleigh Montaigne, who's on the advisory committee, to come by tomorrow and to answer any questions that the committee might have about the program.
Appreciate that.
Included in the packet as well is a memorandum from Steve Purchase to me regarding how many permit applications did we receive during the biennium at the budget hearing. I'd like to have Steve just quickly go through this because I believe this was in response to your question yesterday.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Steve Purchase, Assistant Director for Field Operations. Very quickly, Senator, you asked me yesterday during the budget hearing how many permit applications we had received during the biennium in response to one of the questions about our performance measures and our responses back from customer satisfaction. We have a total of a little over 2,000 applications we received during this current biennium. We try to break them down into how many are pending, how many are NSPs, those are of no state permit needed, how many were denied, how many were withdrawn and closed, how many were authorized, how many were closed by other actions, or how many were extended. And that's just a breakdown. You can take a look at that. But kind of the reality is that a lot of these numbers are, these are accurate numbers out of our database, but there's a couple interesting things. One is that about 40% of all of our work winds up not being a state permit. And that's something that we're trying to do more of, and trying to help people through that process to understand why they might not need a state permit. And then the rest is pretty self-explanatory.
You said 40%?
About 40%.
So there's a big education job to do.
And we do that a lot through the permit application when it comes to us. A lot of folks don't really know if they need a permit, but they go ahead and apply. And we have to work them in the process just like we do anybody, and do that complete application review in that same 40-day time frame. But looking at those, I noticed we're turning those around in about 7 to 13 days. But it's still a piece of paper that we handle.
Well, I'm interested in that because that ties up time and expense for both the applicant and the...
That's correct.
Is that partly because the rules, both at the federal level and the state level, have changed? Or changed periodically, really?
Partly also because a lot of folks believe they have a wetland, or they think they have a wetland on the property and they think they're going to need some kind of permit. They may have gotten some information from the local planning department that says, you're going to need a permit to do this. They may have gotten a notice from our wetland notice process that says, if you're going to do a project on this piece of property, it appears you have a wetland, you may need a permit. It could be response to those. And some people just don't know. So they just hopefully try to do the right thing and they apply for a permit and we work them through the process.
Is part of the issue that if, even though they don't need a permit, they need some kind of a signed letter that to clear themselves or protect themselves from third party or future lawsuits?
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly right. Development community likes to get the official no state permit needed letter of decision from us. So in those instances, they are looking for that. They know they don't need a permit, but they will need that official response from us.
This is an important subject, is why I'm asking some questions. Is there an easier way to do that? Could you have a field man inspect the property and write a notice, or do you have to? Is there a necessity to require that they go through the whole process?
Mr. Chairman, what we have done, and we are willing to do that in the field, but as most of these folks who have actually asked for the no state permit needed determination decision from us, they actually want a process and a decision so they can defend themselves, either the third party or, in some cases, the county may require them to have that as part of their business, building permits, what have you. But they actually have to have a decision from the agency. So that's, if they ask for it, then we process a piece of paper and we just determine no state permit needed.
Is the fee the same for that application as if you were getting a permit?
That's correct. The fee is based on the volume of material moved or filled, and then depending if you're a public or a private or a different consultant, the fee is based on different issues.
Are you asking if there's a fee when we determine that there's no permit required?
Fees are based on volume. If your application shows X number of volume filled or removed, that fee is based on that volume. If it's under 50 cubic yards, for example, in a wetland, then there's not a fee.
Okay, but my guess is that when they want a document saying that the permit's not required, probably a bigger project than 50 yards.
It very well could be, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that I've discovered over the last several years is a lot of the companies that want those kind of decisions, in doing all the work that they asked us to do and perform, they need that official document and an official record that we actually made a decision. So that's a defendable decision on our part.
Okay. Thank you.
The other piece of information that is included in your packet is a memorandum from me to you, Senator Meserle, and that's regarding the 2003-05 Department of Forestry Revenues and Expenditures. In this, we wanted to provide some background information from our June 11, 2002 board meeting, in which the Department of Forestry provided information regarding their revenue projections. That at that time, we received a $26.6 million revenue projection from them. That's what we based our budget on. But I do want to provide you with the information that there was an updated forecast that was put out in November, and they will again be doing one starting in April that will take about another 6 weeks. But that projection in November is showing an adjusted projection in revenues of $20.9 million. So that's down from the $26 million I had mentioned yesterday. Also, I wanted to be clear that the $8.6 million that I had cited for expenditures from the Department of Forestry was a chart that was showing actual expenditures for the 9901 period. Their governor's balanced budget for 2003-05 is $12.2 million. So I wanted to make sure that you had that information.
Where is that on our memo?
There's this memorandum. If you look to the third and fourth paragraph.
Okay. Is that everything?
I believe so. And then we will be working on, we're still working on the information that was requested by Representative Morgan, pairing revenues and expenditures.
And if I could, I see former Representative Terry Thompson just came in. Could we allow him to testify before we start?
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm former Representative Terry Thompson, and I'm only in the Capitol here for a short while today and won't be able to make it tomorrow. But I wanted to come and talk to you a little bit about DSL's budget. And one of the great success stories of the state of Oregon in the relationship working with the industry. We've talked in the past about it, but I think you need to be kept updated. What's going on with the undersea cable business and the relationship with fishermen and DSL and other state agencies. What's gone on is we originally started, we thought it would take 10 years to put three cables in that wrap the world together in the internet through fiber optics. We now have, I believe, seven, with two more, which we've just accepted permits for, to go up off of Seaside. I had the opportunity to go last year on board one of the cable laying ships and actually experience watching the operation go together and the meticulousness that these cables have at making sure they're buried and out of the fisherman's way, and was very impressed. This is the only place in the world that this is done. We're at reaching, I think, 98% burial to 99% burial out here so that we stay away from the fishing industry. We also have an unusual situation of being now designated by the telecommunications industry of being the state that is the leader in being able to be favorable to telecommunications. I think part of that is not only just what happened in the undersea side of it, but what also has happened on the shore side of it. This wouldn't have been possible without DSL's help, without DSL being able to work with us. And it's been a great relationship. I think it's going to go on in the future. You're going to see more of these. Plus, if you're not aware, it's generated, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, I'm sure that if you'll ask DSL, but about $2 million to the Common School Fund from permits that have been granted to allow them to come ashore. And I'm sorry, I can be glad to answer any questions on this, but I wanted to keep it brief because I know you're busy schedule, but I'm not sure how this subject will come up. Sometimes agencies have trouble tooting their own horn, so that's what I did this for.
Question? Terry, thank you. I want to make a comment, though, that I believe it's 99, when there was a lot of activity in, down in my part of the world, and Oregon wasn't very well thought of. We had attorneys in black striped suits from the East Coast telling us farm kids how things worked, and they came to their knees within about 24 hours.
Well, if I remember right, that was AT&T, and that was in your part of the coast. We'd already done one in the North Coast and hadn't had quite that same problem, but I just I look back on it and think it might have been one of the truly success stories to show that industry and state agencies could work together. And in the long run, if you ask those same people today, if you bring them in the room from the telecommunications industry, they say this is the way to do it. One of the problems is there isn't the leadership in other areas in the world that was shown here, and so the Oregon legislature. I think it's truly a success story that needs to be told over and over and over again.
So let me ask you, the other states do not have a committee, fishermen's committee like we do?
After our implementation, California has a fishermen committee. There's one on the East Coast. But in the case of California, particularly in the one that goes into Morro Bay, there's a lot of greedy state agencies out there that have tacked a lot of money on and not made it as appropriate. Plus, there's a lot of fishermen that weren't really involved that got their hands out. And when, if you get too much greed involved, it fails. I mean, it's going to fail for either the telecommunication industry, the state agencies, or the fishermen. Here, we tried to design it without the greed involved. We had trouble with the AT&T, but there's no direct money flowing to the fishermen. It sounds funny, the money goes to the Common School Fund, but we still retain the ability to fish anywhere on the grounds out here. We did have one unburied spot in one of the recent cables, and we've worked out an agreement that seems to be working favorably, but that may come to develop over time.
As I recall, our issue was to protect the fishermen from liability more than cash payout to them.
Right. The very first vessel that hooked the cable, lost $1.25 million is what they charged them. It was done kind of as a shot across the bow to the fishing industry. And then luckily the next cable that came in was the guy who developed and worked on the Alaska pipeline, and he was willing to sit down and talk to the industry and try to come to some common ground, and that's what started this whole relationship. And today we sit down with all the communications people and the fishermen, and we make agreements. We've never had a dissenting vote yet. We had one almost the other day, but we've always been able to work out a reasonable agreement. And when we work out a reasonable agreement, it makes it much easier to come to state agencies and say, this is what we want to do. And this wouldn't have been possible without John Kitzhaber and the Department of State Lands backing us up in the original inception of this.
Is OPAC involved in this at all?
It was kind of interesting you mentioned OPAC, because it came up in a hearing today. And OPAC, we kind of had to drag them along. In the hearing, it was made the comment that they were in the forefront. In fact, we didn't see them until later on. They did finally get involved after they started to understand what was going on. And I'm still not sure their involvement. It was basically the people in DSL that led the issue.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
You bet.
And if I could back up to yesterday, Terry just reminded me that on page 6, your map of land management, you show a line to fiber to Japan and Australia, but that map has got to be way out of date, isn't it? I know there's lines coming in from Asia to down on the south coast, and I think you've got several more lines up and down the coast that are now coming in state.
Senator, that's correct. What we were only trying to do in this map was to illustrate the types of activities, not to show everywhere where we're doing it, because likewise we'd have trouble with a lot of other activities we're doing. But it's just to give a flavor for what we're doing. The one that we recently approved for the cable actually came in through Alaska. This one that went before the land board at the past meeting.
I guess my point is, just to point out for the record, I guess, that it is a big business for Oregon.
Very big business, and it has, I think, immense potential for economic development, too.
Okay. You'll have to tell us where you're starting here now.
Let's see. I believe I left off at the bottom of page 9, so unless you don't have any other questions on trust properties, I'll start at the top of page 10. Another initiative that we were involved with in 0103, Senator, I think that you're very familiar with South Slough. We significantly improved financial reporting and management oversight, revised the management plan. We're in the process of doing that, as well as work closely with the Friends of South Slough. As a result of their efforts, a significant amount of money was raised for exhibits and for the expansion of the visitor center at South Slough. Also, there was a budget note regarding the Natural Heritage Program that was, in fact, transferred to OSU Natural Resource Institute. In terms of land management actions, waterway leases have been increased substantially. You heard from Representative just before me that we had the territorial sea cable easements. We've had rangelands improvements with our partners and lessees. In fact, I brought, you can see what Medusa had. We entered into joint ventures and partnerships with our lessees to try to control weeds like Medusa head and pepperweed, which we're having major problems with in eastern Oregon. And that was very helpful to be able to have the rangeland manager that was hired to work very closely with those at lessees and have a number of projects, including pipelines and wells and fencing that was completed on our rangelands. We also did a rangeland inventory
with NRCS and entered into a fire agreement for the first time with BLM. This is, we've never had a fire agreement for what had previously been unprotected lands, range lands in eastern Oregon. This now provides certainty in terms of fire protection and spells out level of fire protection that we want to have with the BLM. We did rules on land sales and exchanges so that it sets forth clear criteria for being able to proceed with land sales and exchanges. I'll be talking in just a little bit that that's going to be something we're going to be pursuing in the next biennium because our asset management plan calls for us to exchange or sell isolated tracts that are difficult or expensive to manage, and we have a list of individuals who want to purchase those lands. We also did rules on special uses, ranging from communication site leases to if you'd have a movie company that would film on state lands for revenues that would go into the common school.
And is there someplace in our books that shows the, at least list the lands that you have available for sale?
I can get a copy, or I can get a listing of requests that we've had for
is
purchases.
That a big book or how?
Do you want to talk about that?
Mr. Chairman, Steve Pertz, Assistant Director for Field Operations. Ann mentioned that the Asset Management Plan does direct the agency to sell scattered, isolated tracts of land. For over 10 years, as we started to look at our land base, we put together the Asset Management Plan to identify what we should do with all those lands that we have and what we could expect to see for some kind of rate of return. We have put together over those years those isolated parcels that we believe would be good candidates for sale or exchange. And in that meantime, we've through the public process and the public outreach that we've had, we've had quite a number of folks come to us and ask us if we would sell a rangeland that's under lease to the lessee or if we would sell a particular piece of property. So we do have a list of about 80, I believe it is, 80 or 90 parcels of land where people requested to buy that. We can certainly provide that to the committee. We're also in the process of updating our asset management plan update to the legislature and the land board. We'll get you a copy of that too.
Well, I was busy. We're sending notes back and forth about our education committee this morning, so I might have missed this. Do you base this on requests to buy land, or do you base it on properties that are, have no value to the state?
Mr. Chairman, we can do it both ways. We have quite a few of our lessees, grazing lessees particularly, have requested to buy their particular rangeland lease. We also would look at someone's application to us to purchase a particular piece of property. We would then evaluate that application, evaluate what we have going on the ground, whether the property is leased, what kind of economics it has associated with that property, everything from noxious weeds, treatments to trespass issues to you name whatever's going on the land. We look at each one of those and make a determination whether it would be in our best interest to sell that land or to retain it. So it could be done either way.
The reason I'm asking, we went through this last session with, I guess maybe the last two sessions, with ODF&W, and they analyzed their properties that they own, realizing they don't have nearly as much as you do, but based on what is important for their operations and what is access to their operations.
Mr. Chairman, what we did in our asset management plan is we tried to identify small, scattered, unleased properties first as our first potential for sale, rather than try to go out and to look at every single parcel that we own and go through an appraisal expense or a management review of each parcel of land. We try to identify those that we either don't have under lease or we've never been able to get under lease for some reason or another, and say those are the candidates for sale.
Thank you.
In fact, we just sold a parcel to Douglas County just recently, a parcel that was enclosed and surrounded by Douglas County land and was difficult for us to manage and had been decertified by the Department of Forestry for management. So it's parcels like that that we're hoping to pursue. Last on here is the new Carissa lawsuit in which the state prevailed and we won $25 million in a judgment. That $25 million currently sits in a special account pending the completion of the appeals of this. We hope that those appeals will be finished in the next year to 2 years.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Johnson.
I'm delighted to hear that the account is fully funded and that the $25 million is actually there. Have you done anything to calculate the cost to the state of Oregon versus the judgment? We're going to get $25 million. You're going to pursue this through appeals that you anticipate going how much further? Or I'm just trying to get a sense of how much additional money we're going to spend tracking our award at the lower court.
Senator Mezzoli, Representative Johnson, I believe that our legal costs for the case so far amounted to about $1.2 million. We did go to the emergency board and received expenditure authority for that. I don't anticipate that we're going to be anywhere near that for this next biennium. It should be a very small fraction of that because the expense for the $1.2 million involved all the expert witnesses, the multitude of depositions that were taken, and 6 weeks trial. So now we'll just be exchanging briefs back and forth. In terms of the $25 million, will be more than enough to cover our legal expenses, any cost of removal, and there may be some then left over. I'm optimistic.
All your costs to date have been reimbursed, though, is that correct? I'm not talking about legal costs, but I'm talking about DEQ and your staff and everyone else that's been involved.
The Senator, the $1.2 million represents costs that we pay to the Department of Justice for in some cases, it involved the cost of other agencies where they had travel expenses and that. It didn't involve the cost of all our salaries.
Maybe I didn't clarify my question. We had a lot of staff time involved when the ship first went aground with Fish and Wildlife, DEQ, and all that. The shipping company reimbursed us for all those costs. And this, what you're talking about, is only the cost of the lawsuit. Is that right?
That is correct, Senator. Now, there is another lawsuit that is also going before the courts within the next year, and that is regarding the natural resource damages. Our lawsuit was based on the fact that they were trespassing on state land, and we wanted the ship removed. So the next lawsuit, which actually, I believe it, there, the federal government, it's a consortium of federal and state, are asking for around $100 million in damages. And Steve, that is going to trial this fall, I believe.
That's correct.
Yes.
Natural resource damages, what does that entail?
The natural resource damages from any oil spill, a variety of things. And that will, I believe, is being prosecuted under the federal statutes.
Is that common to get large settlements? I'm thinking in this case, I didn't think we had that. We had quite an extensive cleanup operation going, but so what would the damage to the natural resources be?
Senator, I'm not as familiar with that case as the other. I believe it has to do with the wildlife and with the oil spill. This is the first case that, from what I was told by the federal attorneys, that they are prosecuting after the Exxon Valdez.
Where I'm going with this is doesn't seem to me like a tremendously strong case, because the reports that I read were that they never could establish whether the snowy plovers they found, as an example, were killed by the major storms or whether there was actual damage from the contaminants. And so I'd be very concerned if we run up a huge legal bill, or how does this all play out?
Senator Mezzoli, I believe that is essentially being brought by the federal government. So that is not a legal expense on our part.
And do we get interest? The state receives the interest off of that $25 million?
Yes, we do. In fact, we believe that's one of the reasons why the defendants sent us the payment in December, because otherwise, under state law, they would be accruing a 9% interest rate. And so by sending it to us, it essentially stopped right then the interest that they had been accruing. So we received the $25 million plus interest to date from the judgment. So any interest in that account will go to the state. but we have to keep it in a special account that Department of Justice has because it's pending the appeals.
So those funds, both the interest and the $25 million, will be unusable or unfungible or whatever until the case is settled in.
Senator, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
In terms of agency-wide initiatives, we drafted a strategic plan. We're hoping to take that out to public comment later this year. We have a set of a new mission statement, a vision, a set of goals. We're working on providing some individual action items to go along with that, but we will be taking that out for public input later this year. So we hope to have that in place for the 2003-05 biennium, but we did not have a strategic plan in place since the early 1990s. We developed performance measures. We did not have performance measures before, except for the benchmark measure on wetlands, but we had no specific performance measures for the agency. We upgraded our website. We spoke earlier about the improved customer service that we had been involved with by more outreach and also putting surveys out for how we're doing, and we'll be providing training in a couple months. In terms of the Common School Fund, I think with the 5 special sessions last year, that certainly raised awareness of the Common School Fund. In addition to that, I had a number of requests that I honored in speaking before education organizations, for example, the PTA, about the Common School Fund. We also made extensive use of volunteers and students and interns. Our calculations are that it provided us with about $350,000 in services that we otherwise would not have had. And we moved forward on affirmative action, and we made gains in that area, especially with women and African Americans.
And do you have a draft of your new strategic plan and performance?
Yes.
That we could look at before? Or is that part of our presentation?
It is in here under tab 5, shows the goals and actions.
Is that of the yellow book?
This is in this book here.
Tab 5?
Yes. And then there's also a section that shows our vision and our... And I think earlier I showed you our mission statement. I can find that for you in just a little bit, but it is included in your materials.
If you could, mission statement, I know where that is, but if there's something in addition to tab 5, if you could let us...
Right, and that's why I mentioned we have the goals and we have a few actions, but we still need to do a lot more work on it.
And the performance measures, where are they?
The performance measures, and I'll be getting into that a little bit later in my presentation, but the performance measures are behind tab 11. In our budget document, oh, that's the performance measures. It's also in the budget document in tab 3-29. In terms of major issues, I want to talk about specific concerns that we heard about the agency and things then that we tried to do to address those concerns. In terms of the removal fill program, we heard complaints about inconsistency of application of rules, and thus we revised the rules and had a major overhaul of them, did a major effort in training staff and the public, an extensive outreach, as well as with consultants. We held at least 16 meetings and trainings with the public and consultants. Another area that we heard concerns about involved permit coordinators following their own personal agendas. What we tried to do there then was we had all permits then had to go through the supervisors, and the supervisors reviewed and signed each permit so that we improve consistency of those permits and ensure that we weren't having that type of personal agendas. Permit processing being slow, we really embraced Senate Bill 529. We saw that as a way to significantly improve the processing of permits in our agency, and I believe that that is bearing fruit in terms of the timelines in which we're processing them. We also streamlined the process by emailing notice to reviewers, dedicating a website for applications and status.
And let me, in the memo or the sheet we got this afternoon, does it show, do we have a way of tracking the applications that were not complete? I guess we talked about that yesterday too, but do we have the numerical numbers of that?
I'm going to ask Steve Purchase to join us back again, please.
Mr. Chairman, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director for Field Operations. Your question was, do we have a way to track an incomplete application? The answer is yes, we do. We have a land management or land administration system, which is a database that tracks the day the permit is received by us and entered into our database. And then every step of the process through is tracked, and the timelines are tracked with that. Application received, application reviewed, a dormant period where it goes back to the applicant for further information if there's something that we need from them. I talked yesterday about the complete application checklist. Along with the application going back goes a checklist and a review of everything we looked at and what's missing, so you know what you have to give us back. And then we track those dormant times, as we call them, in our database. When the permit comes back to us, we do a quick review again to make sure that we've got everything we need. We track that time. We track how many days we actually do the public review process, which is 45 days by statute. And then we track the final review until the final issue date. And we have a database that does all that for us.
That sounds like you could give us a sheet that shows the percentage that are not complete with the first application, and then maybe identifying why the issues of why it was not complete. And what I'm getting at, I would think if we could track that, you could identify where there's problems, if there are problems in the process.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Morgan asked me a question yesterday about how we are doing in the process with 529. And one of the things that I told her was that one of the things we've experienced since July 1st of 2002, when the new 529 went into process, Senate Bill 529 went into process, is that we have seen a significant increase in completed applications. So one of the things that the representative asked me that triggered my thought, and I went back last night and hand-counted them just to make sure that I could respond, is on July 1st of 2002, when Senate Bill 529 was initiated, we were rejecting approximately 49% of all applications for being incomplete. On January 15th of 2003, when we initiated our new rules, we are down to 22% of permits being rejected from the 49%. So we've been able to cut that in half, so people are getting their reviews brought back in a more current fashion. The big reason for that, quite simply, is in our new rules, we clearly spelled out exactly what you must have for a complete application, plus 16 training opportunities with consultants and watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts, about everybody you can think of to get out and give some training to. We tried to do that over the last several months, and it's really paid off for us.
And of those 22%, are you able to break that down as to where the deficiencies were?
Senator, I did not go through each 22 permits the 22% that have been rejected to figure out why each one was rejected. I did pull about five or six of them last night just out of curiosity again, just to find out why that would have been. So a lot of times they're just simply maps. You give us a map that shows the wetland impact or the area that you're going to impact, and the maps didn't have any lines drawn of where the impacts were going to be. So we really didn't know what you were trying to impact or what your mitigation would be. So those were a lot of the reasons. In the rules that went into effect in January, we also allowed for what I call minor omissions, to let people know that your application wouldn't be rejected because you forgot to sign it, or you forgot to put your phone number on it, or you forgot some little minor bit of information. So I can go back and look at those 22% if you'd like me to do that and come back with you.
It'd be interesting, I think. Do we have a available source of maps that you can pull off the internet? I know in my past life, trying to get these, some of these permits, sometimes it's difficult to get a map before we had the internet too, though. Being able to get a hold of a map that really was of a legal size or that you could utilize to draw in what the impacts were going to be.
Senator Mesley, we're trying to put together a standardized map, if you will, about what we want to show on the map, the impacts of wetland boundaries, those sorts of things. We're working on that right now. We do not have anything posted on the website at this particular time. Well, we're getting very close to having a generic drawing, if you will, put together that would show the kind of information we'd want on a map. We've worked with a couple of consultants and asked them if we could use some of their maps, some of the consultants who have done a very good job of identifying everything we need. We've tried to work with those folks to see if we could use their maps, and we've not been able to do that successfully yet, but we are working toward that, yes.
Well, seeing me in this day and age with all the aerial photos and map work that's done, that some federal agency or someplace ought to be able to, maybe we're not quite there yet, but we must be getting very close.
We're working very hard on that.
Thank you.
Other issues regarding the removal fill program that we've heard. Another one is that the process is cumbersome for small projects. What we did there was to simplify the requirements for small projects, including roads. This is a small project, and this definition is under 250 cubic yards or wetlands less than 2/10 of an acre. We revised our rules, and regarding those small projects, we made it easier for applicants to go through the process, not as much justification required, and limited the requirements that we have on those smaller projects. We also broadened exemptions for culverts, some canals, and ditches, and in one case for irrigation ditches that did not have any fish included. We did not include those at all in our jurisdiction where they had been before. In terms of impeding economic development, this is an area where we're going to need to work on in the next biennium, but we have launched into a pilot project with Sutherland and Lebanon on industrial lands and wetlands, and we're moving forward on that. I mentioned that before. We're also in the process of developing with ODOT a general authorization for bridges as well as one for pilings. This we hope to have next year. So we're in the we just opened rulemaking on that. It'll help streamline their process as well as putting together an agreement with ODOT in working on their permits.
And there's a lot of interest in this session and in the different committees of ways to be more efficient and incentives to get businesses to grow or to expand or get people on the payrolls. And in my county, where we're getting a natural gas pipeline that's going to be starting construction, I think they're letting the bids this week. I can see a potential where there's going to be an awful lot of activity. Are you staffed to a level where you can, I know there's some bottlenecks now, and I appreciate your pilot projects, but are you staffed to the point where if there's a surge of activity that comes through, that DSL will not be a bottleneck?
Well, that's, Senator, that's one of the reasons why we're concerned about the ODOT work that's going to be coming at us, and why one of our program option packages asks for two limited duration positions so that we can make sure we address that workload without taking away from applications that businesses and other entities are asking for.
And I have a, I've had personal experience, I guess, a few years ago when Hyundai was coming to Eugene. Permits around the rest of the state were delayed simply because staff was pulled off to get their permits out of the way. And that's my concern.
And I hear that, Senator. What we hope, one, will be tracking, we're tracking the permits a lot more closely now to ensure that we meet the deadline so we can see whether or not we're starting to push against that. We're going to have to monitor what our workload is right now. The current workload, I think we're okay, as long as we also have those positions from ODOT, so that we can try to address the $1.6 or $1.7 billion in projects that they're going to need the environmental review on that. but I think it, what we're putting into place now with some of the changes are also helping us with our workload.
Do you also have a process in which a major corporation, if they were coming in, such as Hyundai, can either provide consultants or can provide the funding for staff so that they don't put such a burden on your present staff?
Let me have Steve Purchase come and talk with that, talk about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director of Field Operations. Senator, we do have a process in place. It's a pre-application process where we would hope that a company was going to come to Oregon that was going to do a large development would have notified us up front that they were coming and what their needs would be so we could work with them through that pre-application to identify the issues that would be of particular interest to us that we would require a permit for. So through that pre-application process, there's an opportunity to identify what they're going to do and what they're going to need from us. We also work quite closely with Community Solutions team members to have those Community Solutions team members work not only with DSL but with all the agencies to provide whether it's transportation needs, well and renewal fill permits, job training, whatever else we might need from or for that company, we could work as a group to try to facilitate getting that development done. So we can do those things as well.
Thank you.
We've been working hard, as you know, on trying to deal with streamlining of duplicative state and federal programs. We're very close to getting a statewide programmatic general permit. We hope to have that in place at the end of this year and an approval of the biological opinion this summer. That is one area where we have been under discussions with the Corps of Engineers because we're going to save them a lot of work and hope that we can come to an agreement about sharing some workload and some activities so that that will also be a way that we can help with the workload situation. For trust properties, I had mentioned before, I'm sorry.
Didn't you skip over the last point?
Oh, the
navigability.
Oh, I'm sorry, and that was not intended. Sorry about that. Navigability, yes. Sometimes I'd like to skip over it. But
I can't understand that.
Lots of us feel that way.
That was probably Freudian on my part.
I wish they'd skip over it.
This has been a very difficult and contentious issue around since statehood, and one in which we were involved with in the land board on Sandy River and the John Day River. Most recently, there was a decision on the John Day where the judge told the land board they needed to make a decision about navigability on the John Day. There, because it's been such a difficult and contentious issue, Treasurer Edwards took the leadership and formed a work group, bringing together the different individuals and groups involved with navigability. They've been working very hard, as John Lilly can attest. He's been providing staff as well as Inga Deckard on this. And they have also had a number of public meetings recently on navigability. We'll be learning soon whether or not that group is going to bear fruit or not. My hope that it will, but it has been very difficult, and we'll see if they can get there or not, because it is one that people feel passionately about.
Representative Johnson.
Could you give a little more detail on bear fruit? What's that mean?
And let me have John Lilly come up, because he can talk about the proposal that is being discussed right now. What we hope is that if there's an agreement, we would have a pilot project on the Five Rivers, right? Five Rivers, that we would have that in place for the next 4 to 5 years, and that would allow basically a management plan approach to those rivers with agreement about where people can float and where they can be on the bed and the banks. That would take place and be presented to the legislature in the form of a proposed bill. So fruit would be whether or not that could end up being passed this session. Go ahead, John.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Lilly, Assistant Director for Policy and Planning. Ann's description is very apt. The work group, which consists of the cattlemen, the Farm Bureau, the Realtors Association representatives, Northwest Steelheaders, Pack and Fruit Club, the Oregon Hunters Association, and must be someone else, the division, and I think a Deckard from the Land Board, from the State Treasurer's Office. The proposal that the group has been able to pull together, which, mind you, they're all of these groups are kind of saying, this is a proposal we're interested in putting forward, but we're not sure we're all ready to sign on to it. So it's kind of a test drive. But the proposal would be that over the next 4-year period, there would be 5 river segments that, on the North and South Sandy Ams rivers, the portion of the John Day River, a portion of the Rogue River, and a portion of the Trask River, that would be put into this recreation management plan proposal. And basically, recreation management plan to manage the recreation use on those segments of rivers would be put forward. The public would be allowed to use the bed of the river for floating and fishing and legal uses, and 10 feet of the river bank, but only within 10 feet of the water's edge, not up to the ordinary, not way up on the bank, mind you, but rather only within 10 feet of the water's edge. The complicated parts of this proposal are that there would be a funding mechanism, which hasn't been settled on yet, that would provide revenues to contract for law enforcement, to reduce signage and other things necessary to keep these rivers up while the recreation use and what is being allowed. The group is scheduled to meet later this week and ponder what they've heard through these 5 public meetings that we've had in Mill City, Sweet Home, Tillamook, Fossil, and Monument over the last 6 weeks. Incidentally, in Tillamook, last Tuesday night, we had over 250 people in attendance that heard this proposal and presentation from the groups. So that's kind of the proposal, and it's pitched against the possibility that the Land Board may have to initiate navigability studies on these rivers, since those rivers were chosen because there are pending navigability study requests on those rivers that I've described. So it's kind of a truce, if you will, or a pause, seems to be a popular word these days, but a pause in the action of navigability while a management approach is tried to see if that might be the way in which public use can be accommodated and private property rights protected.
If they do come up with a management plan, and at some point in the future someone else requests a study, where does that leave the department?
Well, during that 4-year period, Mr. Chair, one of the provisions of this proposal is that there would be a moratorium on any further navigability studies. Theory, of course, at work here is that management is the key issue. Management of public use and private property rights, and that navigability is often used as a vehicle in which to make the ultimate decision about who owns the beds of banks, and then be able to more accurately and legally deal with the issues of public use. So, if after the 4-year period the project is successful, then it would have to come back to this body to be restarted or re-implemented, and theoretically, if it was successful on those 5 rivers, maybe it would be successful on other rivers, and those could be added.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question that pops into my mind is, at what cost? In a fiscal environment, when we're talking about turning old ladies out of Alzheimer's facilities, depriving people of life-saving medicine, I'm trying to figure out at what cost these navigability studies go on.
Chair, Representative Johnson, insofar as the navigability work group's proposal is put together, they're really, the group is very sensitive to the fact that there are no dollars in the state budget to finance the kinds of things that they're talking about. And so they've been relying upon some other mechanism, either registration non-motorized boats or some kind of voter pass mechanism, where the users would be paying for the services that are provided. Insofar as navigability studies are concerned, the division doesn't have a particular budget item for navigability studies. If the board authorizes a study to be done, we prioritize workload and then conduct the study pretty much with existing staff resources.
Then keying off of a question the chair posed you, opposed to, I think, Ms. Hannes, as you're reprioritizing staff to do these navigability studies, does that mean that Hyundai waits in the queue for their permit? And you've got a finite number of staff and an increasing universe of work. And so where does a business with 1,000 employees land in the queue while we're studying interference with private property rights?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the staff that would undertake a navigability study is not the same staff that would process a Hyundai permit, for example. But there would be some other activity, say, for instance, the support of land sales programs or the support of some other item associated with policy and rulemaking, coordination with other responsibilities in the agency that might have to go to lower on the priority scale. Interestingly, the division has only done, since 1995, the division has been authorized by the land board to only do one study, and that was on the Sandy River. So it really remains to be seen whether there will be another study done in the next biennium. But like I said, we don't have particular staff that's sitting in the wings waiting to do navigability studies. It's a matter of reprioritizing workload.
One last question, Mr. Chair. At what cost was the Sandy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the Sandy River study was done in the neighborhood of $40,000 to $50,000. The majority of that expense was existing staff time. There were costs associated with printing and mailing and rental of facilities for whole public meetings. And then there was a small personal services contract for a historian to do a review of the work.
I just want to make a point before we go to represent the mortgage question. Since the division uses very little, and probably in this case no general funds, rather than comparing it to the elderly ladies in the Alzheimer's unit, my guess is that we're really talking about the common school fund, aren't we?
That's correct.
That more expenditures, that's less money that can go to the common school fund.
Settle for either analogy, Mr. Right. Chair. Thank you for the correction.
Representative Morgan.
So we're talking about poor little first graders freezing their toes off in cold classrooms. I'm curious about the discussions inside the work group with reference to this study or this pilot project that they're going to do. Given that if the revenue source is going to be some kind of permit or licensing fee on people that actually use the river, are there anywhere in the dynamics of the discussion yet where you're trying to figure out what the levels of the fees have to be in order to cover the study and the enforcement and the licensing and all the different aspects that are going to be involved in this project?
Chair Ripson Morgan, those conversations have begun. They're probably not at the detailed level that, say, maybe this nature would get into. The group realizes that if their proposal is to get legislative approval in this session, then that level of detail depending on how the consensus unfolds even this week.
I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair. So you would expect sometime within the next couple of weeks that they would come out with a conceptual proposal to bring to the legislature?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that is the hope.
And the conceptual proposal would simply be, we require some amount of money to have the department plan this project, and here's what the scope of the project would be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, yes, precisely that.
But it, John, it would also, as I understand, make some other changes, such as putting studies on hold for 4 years, and so it there would also be other parts of the legislative proposal that would be included. Not so it wouldn't be just be a fee bill coming, being proposed. It would be a package.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that's precisely the case, and I know that it seems a rather daunting task, but the group has worked rather diligently since August on this effort, and it remains to be seen whether we'll get there or not with something that will fly. But they've been pretty persistent, and there have been a number of times when it looked as if there was not going to be agreement, and yet they continue to come to the table and work in good faith. At this point, I'm to say we're wildly optimistic is maybe painting it too broadly, but people are still talking and there's still a possibility.
And if I might have a follow-up, I'm not real clear on what it is that is going to be attempt to be proven here. Is the thrust of the discussion around some kind of concept that says if we can raise money by some kind of licensing or permitting, we can use that money to pay damages and do enforcement on the banks? Is that what we're talking about?
Representative Morgan, yes, that's part of the package.
And then if that proves to be successful, then what would be the impact on rivers being declared navigable? I mean, if there is to be a moratorium on navigability studies being initiated during some time period that this research project or this experiment was taking place, then after that, if it was found, yes, we could charge permits for this amount of money, and here's how we'll collect them, and then the money can be used for enforcement and damage control, then the navigability studies would then go ahead again, and then we would just be slotting rivers into this permitting process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I think that the vision here is that, let me back up just a bit. One of the reasons that the division, the land board, has presented these navigability study requests is because groups and law enforcement and prosecutors have issues dealing with resolving conflicts between river users and private property owners. And so they turn to really the only legal tool that's available, and that is determining who owns the beds and banks of the river. And that way, then when they're confronted, say when a district attorney is presented with a trespass claim where someone is standing in the river and that trespass objection is coming from the upland property owner, navigability comes into play. But if the rules of the road were clear in state law, and if there were resources available to manage public recreation use along rivers, then the issue of who owns the beds and banks doesn't come into play, because the fisherman knows where he can be, and the private property owner knows where their private property is and what their rights are. That is the ultimate vision here, that if this pilot project were to be successful, then some of the impetus for navigability studies based upon conflicts between river users and recreationists and the public and private property owners might evaporate.
So it, I think, still begs the question that if the pilot project is successful, then does that tacitly lay navigability over all the rivers?
Chair Representative Morgan, I think one might, you might try to make that analogy, but I don't think that would actually be correct. I think that what this is attempting to do is establish the rules of the road for appropriate public use of waterways in a way that codifies kind of the status quo. and provides for resources for private property owners and the local public to deal with issues that relate to public recreation use. It may be that the outcome, if the pilot were successful, and that's remains to be seen, you know, we haven't got there yet. But if the pilot were successful, for example, it may be that, again, the navigability issues, the navigability studies would no longer be necessary to resolve that particular question of management.
I think Senator Messerly, Representative Morgan, the hope is for this pilot project is that the land board wouldn't have to make a declaration of navigability or ownership of the bed in the banks, that a management plan for recreation and specifying what are the floatage rights of boaters and fishers as well as where they can be on the banks would be done in lieu of that.
But I would assume, based on my somewhat limited knowledge of navigability, that it appears that the way that the law has been interpreted is fairly much on the side of people wanting access to the beds and banks and fairly not on the side of the people who are going into the process thinking that they owned them and had the right to use them as they wanted. And so I would wonder whether putting in place some kind of recreational use management statutes would, I don't know whether that would end the discussion on navigability. It would seem to me that there would be, if I was a person that was pushing for navigability designation on rivers, simply having a recreational management process in place wouldn't get me where I wanted to go with it. And I would think that if I was a landowner and wanted certainty on what I did own and have jurisdiction over and what I did own and didn't have jurisdiction over, that having a recreational management plan in place wouldn't answer that question for me either.
Senator Messerly, Representative Morgan, it would not answer precisely who owns the bed and the banks. When we have to look at navigability, we have to look at it according to criteria that the federal courts have developed about determining what is a navigable river. And in determining navigability, we have to go back to whether or not the river was used at the time of statehood for commerce or whatever. So even if a canoe went up and down the river for commerce purposes, that would be one strong point for navigability rather than having to have a large ship as we might think of it today for navigability. So there are certain criteria that we had to go and deal with. I think what this group is trying to get at are the issues of conflict between users and property owners and trying to find a way other than dealing with the particular ownership of bed in the banks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to try to ask Representative Morgan's question one more time so I understand the answer. You work out this management plan for a specified number of rivers. How then does that not become a template for every river?
Chair, Representative Johnson, that's precisely what it could be. It could become a template for other rivers. And if it were a successful template, then it might be a way in which the question of who owns the beds of banks would be avoided. And the real issue of management of public use along private property might be resolved.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Given that you're now headed in that direction, what becomes increasingly worrisome to me is how you can have what is a fairly finite group of folks establishing a statewide template. I can understand how certain members of this group that you read off might have an interest in certain rivers, the John Day, for example. But to somehow say that the work product of this group is going to establish a universal standard strikes me as absurd.
Chair, Representative Johnson, that's why it's only a pilot. That's why it's a four-year, would be a four-year project to see if it indeed works, and it would require reauthorization by the legislature if we were to go farther than that or to go to other routes. And you're right. The group around the table who began this conversation realized that they needed to reach out to folks who might be affected by this pilot project idea, and that's why there were public meetings held in those communities that I mentioned earlier.
That currently have affected rivers.
Those rivers that are proposed in this alternative. We held meetings in Mill City, Sweet Home. We held meetings in Sweet Home, Mill City, John, Monument, Fossil, and Tillamook within the last month. Over 250 people in Tillamook, nearly 100 in Fossil and Monument, and over 100 in Sweet Home and Mill City, where the proposal was presented and discussed and debated.
We should start moving along here. I'd like to get through this section before 40 minutes. But do you have another quick question? This is going to be coming before policy committees, no doubt. And so maybe that's the point.
My only comment question is, how do you define if it works?
And we'll have a chance, or the legislature will have a chance to review that again in 4 years. Anna, I would like to ask you to, under the issue of duplicate federal and state programs, at the meeting I was and a couple other senators were at a week or two ago, you handed out a document that showed how the programs compare for fill and removal. Could you provide that to the committee? I think that'd be very beneficial. And do you have other programs besides fill and removal where you could break that down for us? I'm trying to think what it would be, but I think you covered wetlands, and you covered fill and removal, and I think you covered mitigation, didn't you, in that document?
Yeah, I think covered it. So we can provide you that where it compared the state and the Corps and looked at how it compared between state and federal. We will provide that to the committee.
And that compared both EPA and NOAA fisheries, right?
I believe no. The one that we provided compared the state program on the removal fill program with the Army Corps of Engineers program.
That would be helpful if you do that. And let's proceed. I don't want to. We've taken some liberties here.
Another issue had to do with trust properties. In this case, we heard criticism in the last session that the business community was unaware of the unclaimed property laws. We formed an advisory committee of businesses. We've held 14 seminars around the state, and we sent out 100 inserts to businesses using mailings that other state agencies did as a way to save money. In terms of rangeland grazing, we realized that we didn't have a whole lot of information on our rangelands. And so we started an inventory of rangelands and contracted with NRCS to do that rangeland data collection. We settled a lawsuit that had been ongoing with, actually didn't settle it, we prevailed in the lawsuit with an environmental group, ONDA. And also we worked with concerns with lessees about noxious weeds and funded cooperative projects. And Representative Johnson, what you have before you is one of those noxious weeds, the Medusa head.
Well, we told her that was her lunch.
but you don't want to take that out.
Oh.
We don't want to have seeds on the west side.
Don't trust my wife. She'll be making decorations with it.
Back in the hermetically sealed bag.
Yes. I'm going to talk a little bit about how the agency uses its budget and what our focus will be for the 03-05 biennium. We will be seeking to increase Common School Fund revenues and protect assets. We're looking at ways to stabilize and increase distributions to schools. We'll be working on lease compliance and exploring new opportunities. For example, I'd like to see what kind of opportunities we can explore for more leasing on agricultural land, looking at wind generation on some of our lands, and any other opportunities we might be able to pursue. Also, we need to look at limiting trespass where we have trees being taken, roads being plowed, communication sites going up without them being addressed or paying leases. We'd like to work on selling, exchange, or exchanging isolated parcels. We mentioned earlier about that, but we have applications right now for roughly 8,500 acres that we could sell that would be good candidates. And now that we have the land sales and exchange rules in place, I think we're poised to do that. We also have a position that we're being proposed that would really help us with being able to pursue that.
Johnson.
Thank you. If I understood you correctly, when you're talking about limiting trespass, that you said structures are being built on state property without permission?
Senator Messerly, Representative Johnson, that's correct. For example, we may have a communication tower that's put up. We may have roads that are being built across state lands or...
Let me just go back to the communication tower for a moment. I know how lucrative those sites are. What is your redress now if you suddenly find out that some company has plunked a cell phone tower up on state property? I want to get some indication of how aggressively you're pursuing them.
Senator Mesley, Representative Johnson, I'd like Steve Purchase to come up here and talk about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, members of the committee, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director of the Division of State Lands. Representative Johnson, whenever we find a person in trespass on our state property doing something that they're not authorized to do, we try to aggressively pursue that as best we can given the staff that we have. And those folks who owe us money, we go back and try to get them to give us all the rents that are due us, or through a settlement in outside of litigation, we work out the settlement agreement that they would pay for something and get authorized to be there.
Mr. Chair, could I have a list, if it isn't, or the committee have a list, if it isn't too onerous, on how many instances that has occurred and what the settlements were? I first of all, am incredulous that a communication company would come onto state land and build a tower and then expect to negotiate its way out of a clear trespass. And I'm just curious how aggressively, for lack of another word I can think of, that you guys would go after making sure that you and / the Common School Fund were adequately remunerated.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, over what time would you like that information? Because we've got 143 years of history of trespass.
Well, let's try to make it easy by limiting it to cell phone towers.
Okay,
how often has that happened?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we have two communication site areas that are of concern to us. One is Burns Butte, and one is the top of Steens Mountain. Both those communication areas have had people who have either subleased to another company without getting authorization from us, or someone just decided to put up a tower. And as we find those, we'll work with those folks to get them to get authorized. We have one operator right now who has basically refused to lease from us or do anything that we're probably going to wind up having to go to court with him.
Who is that operator?
I would have to get you the name because they've changed names about three times. That's been part of the problem, is tracking down every time that they make a name change. But I'd be happy to get that for you.
I'd like that.
Okay.
We also, in working with the Oregon Department of Forestry, would like to see a completion of the Elliott Habitat Conservation Plan. Right now, as I understand it, their timeline is looking at early 2005 to have that habitat conservation plan completed. We also will be working with the gravel industry, trying to help them address Endangered Species Act issues, and working on a rangeland health assessment in accordance with our asset management plan. Another item on here that I didn't include, we've had an extensive discussion about navigability, but if we end up having an agreement on that and there does get to be legislation signed, that would be another project for us in the next biennium.
And let me very briefly ask you on the gravel industry. Mm-hmm. Came home Sunday evening. When I came back to Salem, Dredge on the Umpqua was back up the river and looked like it was ready to start. Has that been resolved?
Yes, Steve Carnap.
I was surprised because it had been parked for 3 or 4 months.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, Steve Perks, Assistant Director of State Lands. Not that I'm aware of. We have not issued our permit. I don't believe the feds have made their decision yet.
I thought you told me that you had approved that permit extension.
We have extended the permit for 120 days while we work out our issues with ODFW.
Okay.
So technically, under the state permit, they can operate. I don't believe the feds have made their decision.
I spoke before the OCAPA board a couple weeks ago, and later this month I have a meeting set up with National Marine Fisheries Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife to meet with members of OCAPA.
It was interesting because I was surprised the dredge had moved from the dock back up river.
I guess I'll have to check into that.
Me too. Yeah.
I believe we need to continue with efforts on customer service and make further improvements in customer service, continue and increase our outreach to stakeholders through meetings, advisory groups, communications, and any other methods that we can. We have scheduled customer service training for staff in April and May, and we'll be doing follow-ups to see how well that is going. We want to expand the use of surveys. We talked about that at the beginning, and emphasize a strong problem-solving approach, and we want to implement the statewide programmatic general permit as well as pursue any other streamlining efforts. Another area of focus will be economic development. We are moving forward on the industrial lands project, and we'll see how we can then apply that statewide and what lessons we learn from that, as well as make improvements on the timeliness of permit processing. We'll be moving forward with our ODOT partnership. And then also we'll be exploring ways in which we can use common school fund lands to boost the economy and promote economic development. And I think there are a number of opportunities we've yet to explore there. And I mentioned the Elliott State Forest Conservation Plan.
Senator Morgan.
Could you give us a little bit of more information on the Common School Trust Fund lands and how you can use different mechanisms to boost the economy?
Sure. Senator Messerly, Representative Morgan, we have lands scattered around the state. For example, we have one parcel that is right between Bend and Redmond. It's a prime parcel. It's a full section that is right there in the path of progress. That section could be one which could be a win-win all the way around for the Common School Fund as well as for the economy in Central Oregon, how that is developed. Other states have used such lands where they have leased or sold them and have made quite a bit of money for the Common School Fund and has also been a boost to the economy. We'll be looking at opportunities such as coal methane proposals that are being looked at in Coos Bay, lands that we might be even able to purchase. For example, we still have a number of IOUs from the federal government on lands that are called in lieu lands that they still owe us from the time of statehood. And we'd like to pursue seeing if we can get some lands that may make sense for economic development purposes. For overall agency management, we want to complete and put in place and then monitor the agency's strategic plan. We'll continue with close monitoring of South SLU. We'll fully implement the trust property improvements, subject to being able to have our program option package approved by you, and implement and monitor the performance measures. Our program priority criteria start with number one being our constitutional land management responsibilities. We view that as our top priority. Next is the revenue generation and trust responsibilities on statutory lands. Third is the regulatory and technical assistance functions that are created by statute, such as the removal fill program. And lastly are all our other statutory responsibilities that we have, for example, South SLU and the Natural Heritage Program. The next slide shows this. It's under, I believe, tab 14 of your presentation document rather than 13 for the details of those priorities, showing our land management, the statutory, the estates. Oh, I didn't mention the estates in terms of priorities. Estates are part of the constitutional management. Unclaimed property is included in terms of statutory program management. Removal fill, wetlands, South Slough, and the Natural Heritage Program. The next several slides show you budget-related legislation, and I can either go through this fairly quickly, or if you want to go through it item by item, there. What we have is a listing of different budget-related legislation that you should be aware of. Senate Bill 64 that deal with estates, Senate Bill 82 on easements for state-owned property, Senate Bill 293 on recreation management plans, Senate Bill 467 on developing shovel-ready industrial sites. There are a number of different bills on wetlands. Senate Bill 725 on motor vehicle sale that would be increases would that would benefit the common school fund. Senate Bill 730 and House Bill 2739 that would deal with the sale of common school fund. Senate Bill 751 on the Willamette River. Senate Bill 2545 on mineral rights. 2688 on dredge material royalties and wetland and removal fill programs with 3597 and 3598. Do you want me to proceed with the budget unit details?
I mean, are there any questions at this point?
Or I can go back.
I could hear the gas was going over there. Representative Johnson, go
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you flip back?
Sure.
You've indicated what the bill numbers are and what they do. Have you calculated your idea of the fiscal with each one of those?
Let me ask Jeanette to come forward. I don't know if we have fiscal impacts on every one of them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we have been doing fiscal impacts as they come up in the committees. Some of these bills haven't had hearings yet, so we haven't done the fiscal impacts on them.
Thank you.
We can get it if you want to know.
That's okay.
May I ask a question?
Representative Morgan.
Do the fiscal impacts also include the cost of implementing the program within the agency?
Yes.
Or do they just have revenue implications?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, they have both. You usually show a revenue impact, like, for example, Senate Bill 64 would have a tremendous impact on the revenue coming into the common school fund from probated estates, but it also has a cost for it because we would be probably having to get one more estates person to handle the workload. And that both of those would show on the impact.
Okay.
Now I'm going to get into more of the details on our budget. I'm going to first start off with the Common School Fund programs. Within the Common School Fund programs include the director's office, that's the administrative functions, the land board, personnel, and I also serve as chair of the South Slough Reserve Commission. Field operations include regulatory removal fill permit review and compliance on removal fill law, as well as wetland mitigation assistance with which is assistance with improving, creating, and restoring wetlands and property management. The field operations is under Steve Purchase. In terms of policy and planning, this is under John Lilly as assistant director. This involves developing agency plans, policies, and rules, public information and interagency coordination, wetland conservation and technical assistance. Finance and Administration Division under Jeanette Holman deals with the fiscal services section, It also has auditing services for unclaimed property audits, lease and permit audits, and internal audit services, and the trust property section for unclaimed property and estates administration. The South SLU Reserve Program is operated under a cooperative agreement with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The primary purpose of South SLU is for research, education, and stewardship, and it's also used for recreation. South SLU is near south of Coos Bay. It consists of 4,800 acres of open water, tidelands, and uplands. It's managed for research and education on estuary ecosystems and restoration, and I invite all of you down to see South SLU. It's a very beautiful place. We have 25,000 visitors each year, as well as 4,000 students that visit South SLU. The Oregon Natural Heritage Program, you'll hear more about that tomorrow when the Dean of the College of Forestry, Hal Selwasser, and Raleigh Montaigne will be here to answer any of your questions. But we provide administrative support. The program identifies natural areas with special plants, animals, and aquatic species or rare features. It has a database that is used by public agencies and developers, and it's housed at Oregon State University's Natural Resource Institute.
Johnson.
Thank you. I'm about to ask a question that will demonstrate my blazing lack of knowledge of this department. It seems to me, as you were sort of scrolling through some of the stuff that you do, some of it is, for lack of a better word, natural resource-based or biological in some way, and some of it seems to me to be just plain old real estate and property management and contract management. What's the proportion?
If you, in Senator Meserly, Representative Johnson, are you looking at the proportion in terms of the number of individuals or our budget, or I'm trying to
understand? I wasn't even at that depth of detail. I was just looking at it and trying to figure out, given the backdrop that you've laid over the days of testimony that you've been here, that you're so stressed for people you can't do what you're doing. And I was trying to look at a very macro level. What is it that you do? And the first question, and again, this is a disclosure of how little I know about your budget, but why it is that given all of your responsibilities, you're the chair of the South SLU, which is ostensibly the issues around that, at least as I understand it, have largely been settled. You manage it for scientific research and visitor accommodation. Why it would be necessary for that to reside with DSL? Why couldn't that go to parks, for example? I'm trying to figure out, as stressed as you are for people, what of your activities are natural resource-based in terms of the real hands-on stuff you do with build permits and that, and how much of it is ostensibly administrative, management, leases, property sales, inventories of assets of decedents, that sort of stuff?
Senator Meserly, Representative Johnson, say probably the bulk of our work is in the area of property management and the removal fill program. The South SLU National Estuary Reserve has between 10 to 14 people that are there, that depending on where the federal grants are. I'm the chair of the South SLU Management Commission because I'm designated to be the chair in statute. The South SLU was also designated as an asset of the Common School Fund, and thus its lands are managed by the Division of State Lands.
One last point, Mr. I guess that's fine, and I applaud the fact you're following statute, but I'm also wondering, in this highly constrained fiscal environment we're operating in, to what degree you've looked at your statutes and said, despite the fact that we're complying with the law, this doesn't make any sense.
I think we haven't looked at whether or not to take South SLU out of the Division of State Lands. I think there had been consideration in the past, well before I became director, because I believe that it was in the 1970s when it was debated in terms of where to place South SLU National Estuary, and some of those debates definitely precede me. But in terms of looking forward, it's a kind of a unique type of a land management situation because it's goes beyond what a lot of parkland is managed for, where it is dealing with research as well as education and restoration. So it's a unique type of a parcel.
One last follow-up, Mr. Chair. Believe me, just so the word doesn't go forth from this place that I'm making some weird recommendation about something in somebody else's district, that is not the point of this line of questioning. The point of my line of questioning is to the degree that you're so stressed for people and you've got this varied portfolio, whether or not you as an internal staff have combed through it to see what things in your prioritization, you could actually recommend to the legislature that statute be changed to relieve you of that responsibility rather than just prioritizing within the current law.
Senator Meserly, Representative Johnson, that's one of the reasons why we also launched into a strategic planning process, because we needed to figure out why are we here, why are we doing what we're doing, what makes sense for the future.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, that is in my Senate district. I think that's kind of a fun idea. I'd like to talk more about it someday.
Well, I didn't know that, and I didn't want to be accused of mucking around in somebody's district without knowing what I was talking about.
And you might want to talk to Representative Berger.
Okay.
Moving right along. The next set of slides are going to deal with performance measures. And as I mentioned before, these are our new set of performance measures. So in some cases, we don't have a whole lot of history on them, and we're just really starting with gathering the data on the performance measures. They were reviewed by the Progress Board, and we're planning on doing some more work with Jeff Tryons on this in the future. As they reviewed it, they thought that we were using valid databases, but they thought that we were also a bit optimistic in what we were hoping to achieve in the years ahead. Our first performance measure deals with the Common School Fund. We're hoping to see a Common School Fund in the years ahead that goes over $1 billion, and I think we can get there, given that right now we're at $628 million. If we have improvements in the stock market and continue to add revenues into the Common School Fund, I think calculations that we had, if we met the average 7% gain in investment over the on an annual basis, we could double the size of the Common School Fund in 7 to 10 years. But here it's calling for an annual increase of 4.5% in revenues. In terms of percentage of unclaimed property owners who remit annually, our target for 2005 is 50%. That's up from 33% for 2002. I'd like to see higher compliance on businesses that remit on unclaimed property. The third item that's listed here is the percent of users of DSL lands and waterways who pay appropriate user fees. The 2005 target is 75%, and because we don't have that compiled yet, I don't have that for the current year.
Mr. Chairman, I ask a question.
Yes, Representative Morgan.
I think that it is commendable to try to put as much money as possible into the Common School Trust Fund, but I'm wondering what the discussion is inside of the agency when one of the methods that you're using in order to accomplish that is to increase the permitting and the bureaucratic process that people that use state lands have to go through. And I'm wondering what the discussion is around the economic development opportunities and the chilling effect that increasing the level of bureaucracy and the level of permitting and the amount of time that people have to stay in a permitting process has on people's willingness to start businesses and expand businesses and get people employed. And I'm curious what kinds of discussions that you're having from the policy or point of view when you start implementing more user fees, more permits, more things like that.
Senator Meserly, Representative Morgan, are you speaking with regard to our land management or with regard to the renewable fuel program?
Lands and waterways.
the lands and waterways. I think that you have a program relating to easements over state lands or through state lands, and I just generally want to know what, where you're, how you're balancing the cost of the programs that you're putting into the private sector against the economic development issues. Senator Messerly, Representative Morgan, we'd like to see more development on state lands because as we have more development on state lands, that means more revenue for the Common School Fund. So as we have more leasing of structures on state lands, that brings in more money. So in terms of what we have in place right now, they're done according to a set of rules that we have on waterway leasing, for example, as well as rules that we have for uses for other purposes on state land. So I'm not sure I quite understand what your question is. And I'd also invite Steve Purchase to come up to talk about what we're doing on proprietary management.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director of the Division of State Lands. We have done a number of things over the last several years to try to streamline that process. The first effort on our behalf to try to streamline the process, identify what uses could occur in our lands, occurred when we started the asset management plan. In that asset management plan, we identified all the uses that we currently have on our state-owned properties, either our trust lands or statutory lands, that would require some kind of authorization that could generate revenue to the Common School Fund. We also had a Secretary of State's audit that I believe was entitled Opportunities to Increase Revenue to the Common School Fund, which told us that we need to charge more fair market value rents for all the activities that occur in our state lands. That asset management plan also told us that we needed to revise the processes for our proprietary functions within the agency. And we went through about a five-year re-engineering process on our waterway leasing program and our easement program, where we identified the process, narrowed the process down by putting clear rules in place that tells a applicant what you must do to get your authorization to use state-owned property. The waterway leases currently are a 30-day process to turn a lease around, assuming that everything is in order and everything goes the way we'd like it to go. We have the only approved lease exception from the Department of Justice for our water releasing program, where we can offer to you as an applicant a pre-approved lease that does not have to go back to the Department of Justice to review, keeps our costs down, keeps the applicant's time down as well. We have a number of statutes in place currently that were put in by the legislature that allow for free use of state-owned lands, those statutory lands, where an easement, for example, there is no proprietary fee to use a easement area, but we are allowed to charge an application fee because the statute says it's for free, but it also requires us to condition and process an easement. So we charge a $750 application fee for that as well. So there's a number of opportunities there where we have streamlined the process to the point that we can under the statutes to give people who need access to those lands the ability to do that and still do what we're required to do on the statute.
Well, and I think the point that I'm trying to make here is that when you put a $750 application fee in front of someone who is starting a small business or expanding a business, that's a significant charge that you're putting against that person. And I would think would have a significant part to play in their decision about whether to go ahead or not with what they were wanting to do. And I think that there does need to be a recognition that the state's, the agency's effort to gain money for this Common School Trust Fund through fees and permits does have a price to pay on chilling economic development. And, I mean, I think that we've all seen the same things in wetland development, too, where we get caught routinely between constituents and the department in issues where mitigating wetland is costs way more than anyone would ever realize from being able to develop the property. And so the decision is made not to go ahead and do the development on the property. And it would seem to me that as we're looking at the root causes of the place that we're in economically right now in the state, the major problem is that the state isn't receiving the tax revenue that it was, that was once generated by people working and paying business taxes and personal taxes. And that part of that is because we've been putting in place over the last 8 or 10 years these regulatory bureaucracies that may have some good intent in them, but the overall impact is a chilling on economic development. And I think that that needs to be a huge part of the discussion as the land-based agencies build their regulatory frameworks. One of the end results of this has to be to encourage people to take chances on creating jobs and creating wealth.
I'd like to key off of
Thomas, by Representative Morgan. Could you,
and I'm sitting here trying to think how to phrase this, could you provide us with maybe it's in her book, the amount of revenue in the last biennium, or this biennium so far, from fees and permits, and the cost of operating the program to generate those fees and requests and permits, and also how much you've increased that over the past biennium, how much the revenue has increased by your efforts over the past biennium, and what the additional cost has been to get that increased revenue. I'm not sure you can pull those figures out, but if you could, it'd be very helpful, I think. Because I think it's a valid concern that many of our colleagues here in the legislature have. Is it worth the effort? And I'm concerned. I did not realize that the Sassaloo Sanctuary, as an example, was part of the Common School Fund. So I'm also interested in the staffing and all the cost of that program, if that's paid for, all of it by federal funds, or whether there's some of the common school funds that are paying for those programs. And we're just about out of time, so if you wanted to answer that when you come back, it'd be fine.
Senator, in terms of the Sassaloo Reserve, they receive $1 million.
Yeah, and where are you at on that?
Those are notes for me. That is also in your budget document here on Sassaloo.
Tab 7.
Right. If you look on 7-23, it shows in there the total budget. Other funds of $1,037,000, although I don't believe all of that other funds is common school fund, but the majority of it is. And federal funds are just about a match to that of $1,037,000.
So the operation of that program, the sanctuary, does take money out of common school fund. How much money does that generate? Or do you, 'cause you do charge some, don't you?
No, we do not charge fees for the Sassaloo. Not that I'm aware of. There is a gift shop there, but that revenue, I believe, goes for activities of the Friends of Sassaloo for profits of that. But they do substantial outreach to schools and education for schools with children coming to the Sassaloo National Estuary. And the lands itself are considered to be an asset of the Common School Fund.
But if I recall the slide that you had on that, the percentage of children in terms of the total visitors was much less.
They had about 4,000 children visiting South SLU on an annual basis, as well as they've done a lot of outreach. For example, they had an interactive web show or activity where they had school kids be able to interact with scientists and others that are involved with questions and research on estuary and ocean issues.
And I don't want to mislead. I understand that there's a lot of good programs at the sanctuary. Where I'm coming from is that if we're trying to generate as much common school fund as we possibly can, I don't think we can avoid taking a hard look at some of these costs. And is there a better way to fund some of these outreach programs that would not take away from the common school fund? So. And I think we're going to have to call this to an end for today. And I'm wondering, Sue, have we scheduled for Thursday?
Mr. Chair, yes, we are scheduled for Thursday. There is I believe it's a DEQ grant that's up first, but I'm told that won't take very much time.
So I think what we should do, Ann, is plan on at least an hour tomorrow for public comments, since we have advertised it. Public testimony tomorrow, and then if we have leftover information we need to go through, we can do that finished up on Thursday.
Great.
With that, we'll close the public hearing and adjourn the committee.